The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's Author Events Office, and I'm excited to be here tonight to introduce Robbie Krieger. One of Rolling Stone's 100 greatest guitarists of all time, Robbie Krieger is best known as a member of the legendary rock band The Doors. He wrote or co-wrote some of the group's biggest commercial hits, including Light My Fire, Touch Me, Love Me Two Times, and Lover Madly. While The Doors have sold over 100 million albums worldwide, inspired Oliver Stone's popular biopic feature film, and have received a Lifetime Achievement Grammy, Krieger has also become a Grammy-nominated solo artist, an accomplished painter, and he is the co-founder of the annual Medlock Krieger Rock and Roll Golf Classic and All-Star Concert. He joins us tonight with Set the Night on Fire, Living, Dying, and Playing Guitar with the Doors. In it, the reserved musician describes his childhood, the Doors' triumphs and tragedies, and the frank details of his own personal struggles and triumphs. One review calls it an intimate and honest look inside one of the most compelling outfits in music. It towers above the piles of other Doors documents as a powerful reminder that the truth can be more fascinating than the myth. Tonight's author will be in conversation with David Frick, a music journalist I've enjoyed for a long time. He has over a more than 40-year career, proven himself to be one of music journalism's brightest lights. He currently works as senior editor for Rolling Stone and as a Sirius XM radio host. Robbie, David, thank you both so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Well, thank you for that intro, and Robbie, it's very good to talk to you again. I'm actually originally from Philadelphia, so the fact that this is tied in with the Free Library in Philadelphia, I actually lived basically like a stone's throw from the library for quite a few years. I'm curious.
Did you see the show the other night? We were just there.
I'm in New York. I'm originally from, I moved to New York many years ago. But one of the things that was interesting about your story on the road with the Doors is you played in Philadelphia quite a bit. You played there in June of 67, really just as Light My Fire was going, you know, pretty much all the way as a single. Do you have any memories of playing in Philly? You played at Town Hall in 67. You recorded part of Absolutely Live at the Spectrum in 1970.
Yeah, I remember the Spectrum. I don't remember the other one. But the Spectrum was pretty cool because it's in the round, right?
Yeah, the big arena, yeah.
Yeah, and we had all these policemen escort us up on stage. Each guy had three cops with their arms around them, like, you know, like we're moving like a crab all the way up to the stage.
It's like you literally had a police escort just to walk from the dressing room up to your guitar.
Right. I mean, people usually think of the Doors as the cops, harassing us or arresting us. But this time they were helping.
They were protecting you.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because you talk about the Doors' life on the road a lot in the book, Set the Night on Fire, and we should say it was Robbie worked on it with his co-writer, Jeff Aloulis. And one of the things that's really almost like a running theme in the book is the power and unpredictability, especially of the early shows, you know, whether it was at the Whiskey or when you started playing at the Matrix, the Fillmore, and slowly taking it across the country. And yet so little of that aspect of the Doors was recorded live. When you did that box set in 2003, Boot Your Butt, you put it together from bootlegs.
Right.
And then really the great live recordings weren't until 1970 for Absolutely Live. Did it bother you subsequently that so little of your original concert history and power was recorded?
Very much. I mean, it wasn't recorded. I mean, I wish it was, you know, I mean, in those days, people didn't have even iPhones or anything to record with. some guys would sneak a little cassette player in sometimes. But I wish there was more recordings of us.
It was remarkable that there were as many bootlegs as there were, because you were able to actually even include excerpts from Jim's raps at the Dinner Keith Auditorium in Miami. Someone was clearly documenting you. It just wasn't somebody you knew.
Right, exactly. I guess there were even bootleggers back then. But, you know, most of them are pretty bad sound quality and hardly any video. But there's a couple things out there we're still working on trying to get possession of.
What do you think that people can read about what that experience was like in your book, in, you know, other accounts, and actually even reports from the time, even some of the newspaper reviews? But what do you think people didn't or maybe don't understand about how strong and powerful the Doors could be on stage? What is the thing that they can't really access, even though the records are as strong and definitive as they are?
It's one of those things. You had to be there, right? And, like I said, we only recorded two concerts on purpose. One was the Hollywood Bowl, which actually just the other night they had.
There was a theatrical screening for it. Yeah,
theatrical release all over the world one night. And it did so well, I think they're going to put it up again next month. So I went down and saw it. It was pretty damn good, I have to admit.
Well, it's interesting because in the book you describe that evening and that event, and you mentioned that it was a great musical performance. And you can hear the live recordings; they've been released as albums and such. But you also mention in the book that on stage that night, Jim was a little more restrained than normal. He didn't have that sort of unpredictable, you know, hand grenade quality that was so, elementary to his legend. And it's almost as if you seem to think it was nerves.
Well, we might be talking about two different shows. Okay.
Okay.
When I was talking about that one, that was the Isle of Wight show.
Okay.
Okay. That was, and at that point, Jim was kind of really in a bad place because he was, you know, he had the Miami thing hanging over his head.
Right.
I think they had just given him 6 months in jail. He was appealing it, but, he might have had to go to jail in a bad place, Miami, Dade County, Rayford Prison. So, and, you know, I remember that night, even though he sang really well.
Yeah, it's a great recording. I've heard the live album. It's a great recording.
Well, if you check out the video, it's pretty boring because he told the light guys, turn the lights off. I don't want any lights, you know, just one green light is all you get. And he didn't hardly move off that microphone. Now, the Hollywood Bowl starts out kind of like that because he took acid that night. And I remember Mick Jagger was sitting with Jim's girlfriend right in the front row. And he might have been
a little unnerving.
Yeah, but as the concert went on, he got into it, man. It was pretty damn good.
Because there is great moment, I guess, in Unknown Soldier when he collapses onto the
right
floor, and just, you know, you can tell he was definitely in the moment right there.
Yeah, and then in the end, the song "The End," he really was into it on that one too.
How much do you think the fact that, you know, you weren't recorded live or filmed as much as maybe the legend now we would like to have it, how much do you think that came from the fact that, and you talk about this in the book, that amongst a lot of the big 60s acts, it was a rare thing that you didn't have really formal business management, you know, you had Bill Siddons, who really started out as your tour manager as a very young man and kind of graduated to the role. And you had a couple of guys early on who were doing it, and you kind of got them out of the way because they weren't really.
Yeah, they didn't do that good of a job.
Yeah. But you actually ended up doing a lot of that work because you talk in the book about actually dealing with the money and, you know, making sure everybody showed up on time. You know, you were sort of doing that, which is not something the guitar player is supposed to have to do.
Well, I was, you know, I was a math major at school. And so at least I knew about money and stuff. You know, my dad was pretty good with that. But, you know, after a year or so of that, that was when we were just starting out, you know.
Yeah.
And, but you're right. We never really had like a pro manager. And maybe we would have had it filmed more if we did. But, you know, if you look back in those days, there's not much film of anybody. You know, you got the two big concerts, the Monterey Pop and
Woodstock.
Right, Woodstock.
Yeah.
Really, that's and we missed both of those. You know, the Woodstock was Ray Manzarek's fault. He says, "You kidding, man? We can't do that. Let's not do that. Nobody's going to show up. It's too far from New York City."
As someone who drove from Philadelphia, I can tell you it was not too far.
That was possibly the biggest mistake we ever made.
It's also interesting that you didn't play Monterey Pop, and you point out in the book that it might have actually almost been a political thing with Lou Adler, who was one of the organizers, and a guy who was interested in producing you, and you went with Paul Rothschild and Elektra, and that you may have, you know, paid for that a little further down the line.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we really should have been at Monterey, because you know, all the bands we were playing with at the time were there. You know, Janis and the Airplane and the Dead and Hendrix. And though we hadn't played with Jimi Hendrix yet, but we did later. Yeah, I think it was a political deal.
Yeah, and also Monterey Pop would have happened almost exactly as Light My Fire, you know, got like number two. You know, it was like literally in that month that you would have been really the thing, along with the way Jimmy came out and the Who made their stand, and you know, that could have been really a defining moment for you.
Well, the other problem was we were stuck playing this club gig in New York.
Oh, the Action House in Long Island. Yeah.
Well, that, and also we were playing at the Scene,
Steve Paul's place. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure we could have got out of that one.
Well, did you keep any kind of a diary or log at the time, either at the period when you were sort of dealing with, you know, getting paid at the end of the night, or, you know, even afterward, just to keep some idea of how this was going and getting your thoughts on paper
happening? I should have. But I didn't. I was terrible at stuff like that. Even today, I I don't even do the calendar on my iPhone, you know.
Did Ray or John keep anything like that that you were aware of?
No, we were.
It was just all too fast for you.
Yeah. I mean, it was really fast, and none of us were really business minded like that, you know. Now Bill Siddons, I'm sure, had a lot of records, you know, of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I got to ask him about that.
When did you decide that it was time for you to write a memoir of your life with the Doors, with Jim? What was the primary trigger for you to do it now?
Probably the pandemic, you know.
It's a great inspiration to get stuff done.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually started writing this about 25 years ago, right after Ray's and John's book came out. Mm-hmm. You know, I started writing my side of the story. And what happened was, you know, those two guys kind of put each other down in the books, and it caused a lot of problems. So I said, well, I'll just wait a little while. You know, I don't want to stir up any more trouble, you know. And yeah, ended up, we had a lawsuit. You know, John was mad because Ray and I went out again as the Doors.
Yeah.
And it's a long story, but it's in the book.
It's in the book. Well, what did those books, I don't want to say, you know, Ray and John's books, what not so much what they lacked for you, but one of the things that I find interesting, having read all three of them, as well as the No One Here Gets Out Alive, the Jerry Hopkins, Danny Sugarman thing, is that all of the books seem to have, you know, they all have different perspectives because they were obviously written from the perspective of the author, the person playing that role in the band. And it's interesting how it's really books like that are almost like how people remember what happened as well as what actually happened. It's like, what do you retain from that moment? And it sort of shows how yourself, Ray, and John, for all of the bond you had within the band, were very different people.
Yeah, you could say that for sure. You know, in my mind, when I'm writing this book, I just want to get stuff right, you know, especially, you know, talking about the movie and No One Here Gets Out Alive, which both of which had a lot of excess, you know, interpretations of things. So, you know, I just wanted to let people know how it looked from my standpoint.
Because it actually shows when you read all three and now with your book that all of this is really filtered through your different relationships with Jim, how each of you related to him really in different ways. You know, Ray very much, you know, talking about the shamanistic quality that he wanted Jim to have and carry on beyond his passing. You know, John could be very frank about how, you know, Jim would drive him insane with his excesses and behaviors. And in your case, it's interesting that sometimes you come across as someone who was almost like in the middle, almost like a mediator or a facilitator at times.
Well, I would say, you know, I just was having fun, you know. To me, it was just the greatest thing that ever happened, you know. And, you know, the other guys, like John, he kind of, you know, I mean, the point is, whether we liked it or not, we all knew that this was going to be something worth doing. And it was going to happen one way or another. So I just decided, hey, let it flow, man. It's the 60s. Let's have fun. And, you know, to keep it, let's just keep it cool, you know.
Well, one thing that we've talked on a number of occasions, and one thing that I definitely did not know, because it never came up in any of our conversations, is that you were a classmate with Bob Weir at Menlo, a prep school, I guess, in what is now called Silicon Valley. How much interaction did you have with Bob? Because you talk about the whole jug band and the folk blues scene that was really happening at that school and in that
area. Yeah, well,
area.
Actually what happened was he went to the school, Menlo, and I went the year after. So I was not with him when he was in Menlo.
Oh, he was an
Menlo.
Alumnus.
Yeah. Or I don't know. He might have just gone somewhere else that next year. But I really never even got to meet him during that time. So I guess I explained that in the book pretty much. But
well,
it was kind of, all I'm saying is that I knew about him. God damn, this phone. I decline. Okay. All right. We're still there?
Yeah, we're still good. It's the Zoom age. Everybody can deal with it out there. Everybody's cool with it.
Yeah, but you know, people talked about, oh man, this Bob Weir guy, and they had this jug band, and Mother McCree's.
Mother McCree, because you actually saw Mother McCree, the Uptown Jug Stompers.
Right.
There's not a lot of people that can say that. So,
because they were. It was right near our school. It was almost walking distance to where they were playing, and you know, this was before the Dead and all that. So we weren't going to see Bob Weir, especially.
Yeah.
We just wanted to see this jug band because some of the guys at Menlo when I was there wanted to do a jug band, and we did. Ours was called the Back Bay Chamber Pot Terriers.
That's a name very much of its time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you lived anywhere near Boston, you would know.
What
they're talking about.
Well, one of the things, and this sort of relates to, we were talking about the difference of sort of perspective and relationships in the band, and particularly with Jim, that come through in the different memoirs. But one thing you touch on, we've talked about it in interviews, but you describe it in a lot more depth in the new book, is the writing relationship you had with Jim in the Doors. You were the last member to join after those demos that were done at World Pacific in 1965. But you had a chemistry with Jim as a writer that was interesting because it was stronger, I would say, than maybe the one that he could have had with Ray or John. But he talked about this one period where Jim was staying at your parents' house with you, and you're working up things like Strange Days, Crystal Ship, Waiting for the Sun. You've got that guitar lick that you got from Spider John Kerner for Love Me Two Times, the Raga licks that you combined with Jim's words for the end. And at the end of that graph, you write, "Finally, like Ray and John, I saw it." Can you describe or characterize what that "it" was?
Well, it was basically his words, you know, and how great he was with poetry. And, you know, because, you know, before I joined the band, I had read, you know, all the, you know, stuff, Moonlight Drive, and those first six or eight songs that were on that demo. And it was pretty cool, man. Those words were unlike any rock and roll lyrics I'd ever heard. And Ray was smart enough to know that too. And that's when he met Jim on the beach. We all know that story.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I first joined the band, you know, I didn't actually get to see Jim writing or look at, you know, All I saw was the words on paper and on that demo. And that was enough to draw me in, you know, to want to join the band. But getting to actually sit down with Jim and write stuff, that was different. That was pretty cool.
Do you think it was the fact that you were the guitarist that made it easier for him to sort of work with you in a musical partnership? Because he didn't really write in the same way with Ray, who discovered him essentially on the beach with these lyrics, John. And everyone had great vital ideas for the arrangements, but the primary writing chemistry was yourself and Jim.
Yeah, it's kind of turned out that way. Because, you know, the first songs, you know, Moonlight Drive, Hello, I Love You, and those, you know, three or four others, you know, Ray actually put that music together from Jim's, you know, when Jim was first writing that stuff, he just heard it in his head. It was actually like a concert playing in his head.
He could hear the melodies inside.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And he would sing those to Ray, and Ray would just put kind of a blues, you know, background to it. I think, you know, I came from a different place where, you know, kind of folk music and flamenco and stuff like that. So to me, you know, that was what I didn't like about rock and roll, is that it was usually three chords and, you know, kind of boring for the most part. Yeah. You know, it changed later on, of course.
But you came from that background with flamenco and obviously folk blues, which had, you know, a bit more sort of developed musicality.
Yeah, jug band music, you know, and jazz. And, you know, so it was just really fun to, you know, I would play Jim something and he'd just come up with these words right off the top of his head. You know, I later found out that he actually took some of those words from poems he had written like when he was in high school.
Yeah,
like for instance, on "Light My Fire," at the very end of the song, he says, "Oh, let's change that come on, baby, light my fire to try to set the night on fire." I said, "Okay, that's cool." And then just recently, I found out that "try to set the night on fire" was was from one of his early poems, like when he was much younger.
And actually, famously, Horse Latitudes, which is the spoken piece with the synthesizer and percussion and the sound effects on Strange Days, was in fact a poem that he did write in high school, which is really a striking achievement for, you know, a 15, 16-year-old to be writing about Spanish galleons stuck in, you know, the dead winds somewhere in the Atlantic. It's really an
astonishing piece. Yeah, it was about in the Mediterranean. They used to have these rafts that transport the horses across to Spain. And sometimes they would get stuck out there and, you know, be calm, basically. And they would have to throw the horses overboard because they were, you know, so thirsty. And, you know, it was like torture for the horses. And just think of a mind of Jim Morrison putting that in those words. I mean, it's crazy.
I remember when I got that record and listening to that piece, the piece itself was extraordinary. But when he gets to the line that says, and the first horse was jettisoned. Yeah. Who used the word jettisoned in like 1967? I'm like, that really, I think in many ways, as a writer, he was really quite underrated because so much of his celebrity was bound up in the way that people thought he acted like a poet when in fact he really was a cultivator of words.
I think people are going to find that out too as time goes on. In fact, they just came out with a new coffee table book with all of his lyrics. Have you seen that?
I reviewed it for Mojo, the collected works. One of the things, and it's interesting because we're talking about writing and, you know, your book, Set the Night on Fire now. But one thing that struck me about the collected works that was just published was Jim's ability to almost be a reporter. You know, he had a power of observation, and there's a section in there where he's attending, obviously, the trial in Miami, and he's describing some of the jurors on the panel. And the way he's describing them, and there's one thing that he says in there that really struck me. He's talking about, you know, being in this place in this trial, and he says, I've been leading a commune life, shielded from adults, Miami and education. And this is something he's writing not for a song, not for some published work, but it's like a note to self.
Yeah.
And it's really both articulate and quite vulnerable, which is a quality that people would not have associated with him, vulnerability.
Yeah, you're right. And there's quite a bit of that type of stuff in there. And, you know, I think a lot of times he was embarrassed to kind of talk like that. I think if there was only him and a couple of good friends, maybe he would really just talk like that, you know. And I mean, he was a very perplexing person. And it's too bad he was here for such a short time.
Yeah. Well, one of the other impressions that I get from your book, Set the Night on Fire, done with James Aloulis, is that there's a story, and we've talked about this incident before, but it sort of gets to what I think was almost like an unspoken mediating role that you had in the band with Jim, because there's a story you tell of Jim calling you in the middle of the night. He's freaking out because he and Pam have taken way too much acid. And they're asking you to help them come down. And the thing that strikes me about that in retrospect after our discussion and reading it again is he didn't call John and he didn't call Ray, who, being older and, you know, the guy who had been his first real supporter in getting this band together, would have been more like a natural father figure. Instead, he called you. What was it about you that you
probably
think connected?
He probably knew that he could get away with it, with calling me rather than the other guys.
You wouldn't get yelled at as much.
they would have just gone back to sleep. You know, they wouldn't have actually gone over there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't mind going over there. And but the problem was the next day we were going to record, you know,
you were doing When the Music's Over.
When the Music's Over. So you know, I didn't want him to blow that, you know, so I said, okay, I better go get over there and try to, you know, get them to go to sleep or something. And so it's all in the book, but I go over there and they're naked for one thing. and they're trying to get me to take acid. I said, no, man, we got to record tomorrow, you know? And, oh yeah, I forgot about that. So I said, all right, well, let's go over across the street to the park, you know, because when you're on acid, sometimes it's better to get out and
just
nature.
Be outside. Yeah.
Yeah. And they said, oh yeah, okay, that sounds great. Let's go. And they're running out the door. I said, wait, you got to put your clothes on.
Minor detail. Yes.
Yeah. And anyway, obviously the next day we're in the studio and no Jim, he didn't show up. So.
But he did actually come and do his vocal overdub. And as you pointed out,
he
got it
after.
In one take.
Right.
So, well, but there's a lot more detail in the book. So everyone.
Now, who knows whether if that hadn't happened, if I hadn't gone over there, would he have actually, you know, would Music's Over have been as good as it turned out?
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Well, it's interesting because you point out several times in the book how in many ways, Jim's legend, you know, it was almost as if he became a target and that it had as much to do with people's misconceptions of his sort of ambitions and his sort of rebellious streak. Like there, when you talk about playing on the Ed Sullivan Show and when he sings, you know, higher theoretically because of it's contrary to Mr. Sullivan's wishes, you suggest that it was not out of arrogance or being a troublemaker, but almost nerves. He just plain forgot. And even with the whole melee in Miami in March of 69, as disastrous as the show was, you seem to think that largely it's what people thought he did, not what he actually did. And that there really is a lot of misconception about, you know, what he really did versus what people want to believe he did.
Well, I think he wanted to do it, but, you know, because he had just been back home in L.A. He was going to see this play every night.
Oh, the Living Theater,
Living Theater, which was pretty much naked. Everybody was naked. They would go out in the audience and kind of confront people, and Jim loved that, you know. So I think that's kind of what his idea was that night at Miami. But, you know, what happened was... it was actually a pretty good, it wasn't a good show because he didn't sing the songs very well.
There wasn't a lot of music playing.
Yeah. I mean, three or four songs and then he would stop and then, you know, they start berating the audience and trying to rile them up and this and that. But you know what? When the show was over, I mean, yes, the stage collapsed and all that stuff, but we were upstairs. We went upstairs to the dressing room and the cops come in and we were having beers with the cops. You know, nobody got arrested or anything like that until a week later when all these like politicians who were running for office at the time decided to make a big deal about it and see if they could, get some free votes out of the deal. So it was really a BS deal. You know, I mean, we've actually played worse shows than that.
Well, that's all in the book too. The good shows and the ones that didn't go so well. I wanted to ask you about some other things that you discuss in the book, and it's that you get into some very strong detail, in particular about your twin brother, Ronnie. You write about him with great affection and sorrow because of the difficulties he had. And you trace a lot of this to an experience he had, a very bad experience he had on acid when he was 18. How hard was that to revisit for you in telling, really, because his story is tied in with your story of the Doors, because in fact, you took him out as a roadie for a while.
Right. Yeah. He wasn't really musical like I was. He was a golf guy. He was like a number one golfer on his high school team. And yeah, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a professional golfer. But he you know, he had some mental kind of problems. And it's weird because John's brother had the exact same thing.
Oh.
Yeah. And Andre's brother, who just passed away a week ago, Rick.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Oh, Rick, he was the original Manzara. Rick of the Ravens. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was weird, all of us. And then Jim's brother, Andy, he's pretty cool, but he's a little weird too. So we all had kind of weird brothers. Yeah. But my brother Ron was just a really cool guy, and he actually introduced us to Bill Siddons, who became our manager.
Right.
You know, he brought him to a show we were doing up in San Francisco to help Rhodey, you know, and we're at the Avalon Ballroom. And I don't know if you've ever been there, but there's a huge fight upstairs that you have to drag the gear.
Because it was an upstairs ballroom.
Yeah. And so my brother's, you know, dragging an amp up, you know, one step to the next, and the other guy was doing the same thing. And here comes Bill Siddons, one amp in each hand, and he's running up the stairs. I go, uh-oh, we gotta get this guy on our team.
Yeah.
And he's a great guy, Bill Siddons.
How hard was it for you to revisit your own passage with drugs in the 70s and the 80s? You know, in effect, you had to, by writing about it in the book, you had to admit that whatever judgments people made about, say, Jim's drinking, you had your own path, which you had to go through and learn from in a really difficult way. Was that hard for you to revisit? But obviously, if you're going to write a book about your life,
yeah, I wondered.
You got to go there.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought. I've read books by some of the other guys, you know, in bands, you know, like Keith Richards and Bob Dylan and Robbie Robertson, and mostly they kind of gloss over the drug stuff, you know. And you know, I thought in my mind I would be the last guy that would ever get hooked on hard drugs, you know. I mean, Jim taught me, you know, about that. My mother had the same problem, and my grandma. So I was well aware of the fact that, hey, you shouldn't do this, you know, but, you know, I'm an idiot. didn't listen to myself.
Well, it's good to hear in the book
that you did eventually
listen to yourself.
And yeah. Yeah.
Made finally. The passage through.
But it just shows that it can happen to anybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's you shouldn't get too complacent.
We have questions here from our audience, our listenership, our viewing crowd. And I want to start with one from Logan Vincent. And actually, this is kind of a hip question because he wanted to know what was the inspiration for the new album. He says it was, Logan, I'm hopefully assuming you're a guy. It was ridiculously good and some of my favorite jazz fusion music I've ever heard. The album, by the way, is called The Ritual Begins at Sundown. It came out last year and it includes a version of Yes, the River Knows from Waiting for the Sun. What was the inspiration for doing the album that way, almost like as a real jazz fusion record in 2020?
You know, that's kind of what I've been doing ever since the Doors. I've had, you know, many solo albums which incorporate mostly jazz and blues and, you know, just stuff I like to play. You know, I realize that people don't really want to hear that stuff from me because they want to hear the Doors when I play. But, you know, I'm luckily in a position where I don't need to do it for the money. So I do it for the fun of it. And yeah, there's some pretty cool stuff on that record. A lot of the guys I used were from Zappa's bands.
Right, like Arthur Barrow, bands. Yeah.
Yeah, Arthur Barrow, who's been my buddy since the early 70s. And then Tommy Mars, who's Zappa's keyboard guy.
Yeah.
And let's see, Chad Wackerman.
Oh, the drummer, was, yeah.
Right. And a couple of different drummers. Tom, I can't remember his last name. But anyway, and I had various horn players. I had another bass player, Kevin Brandon, who played upright, and he played with Aretha Franklin for like 20 years.
Because actually your first album, your first solo album that you put out, I guess it would have been late 70s, early 80s, was actually released on Blue Note, which is the legendary jazz label. So you actually had that connection, you know, very early on, which was thing to have.
I think at the time I was the only white guy on Blue Note. So well, that was kind of cool.
We have a question here from Troy Resigue. Sorry, Troy, if I got your last name a little scrambled, but you've actually got a good question here. Did Robbie or the band ever think a lyric Jim brought to them was too far out there? Is that even possible?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. You know, there was some stuff that just was really hard to make it fit into, Texas Radio, for instance. If you watch the Hollywood Bowl video, we do Texas Radio with totally different music. It's just kind of, we're just kind of doing this weird avant-garde kind of stuff. And then by the time it got onto L.A. Woman, it's a whole song, even though the words are still kind of more poetry than lyrics.
Yeah.
But I think it really worked good.
Was it would he bring the lyrics in for you to sort of figure out? Like, would he bring the lyrics in fully formed? Or did they change as the music sort of...
It was more the other way. Usually I would have some kind of music, and sometimes we'd all, me and John and Ray, would work it up into a song kind of thing, and then Jim would try to fit some words into it.
Yeah.
Like Peace Frog, for instance, was done that way. And he couldn't think of any words, so he says, all right, let me look in my poetry book, you know. He always had a notebook with him, you know. And he finds this poem called Abortion Stories.
Yes.
So somehow that didn't make a good title. So he changed it to Peace Frog. Don't ask me why.
Well, it's a memorable title for sure.
Yeah.
We actually have one here from Regina Littman, and that actually ties into something you talk about this in the book. As a guitarist, what do you think of Jose Feliciano's version of Light My Fire? And she actually points out in parentheses, I was a rock and roll girl and preferred the Doors version back then. Nevertheless, she wanted to know what you thought of Jose Feliciano's version.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way as her. But but then as time went on, I really did start appreciating his guitar playing in that song. And, you know, even though he did the song in a much more commercial way than we did, the guitar playing is very cool. And what happened was after he did it, that song actually became a standard because it was so much more commercial than ours. You know, maybe if he hadn't done it, Light My Fire would not be such a standard like it is today, you know, where thousand different people have done it, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's one here we've got from actually this is from Susan Kershaw, and this has got to be a question you get hit with all the time, and it's probably cool to change your answer every time just to keep it varied. But the question is, what Doors song and or album is your favorite?
Oh man, that's a tough one, you know.
It is.
I would say album-wise, it's between the first album and the last album. So either The Doors or, you know.
Or L.A. Woman.
L.A. Woman.
And why would it be either one of those two?
I think just the way they were recorded. The first album, we'd been playing those songs like at the Whiskey and places like that, like every night, you know. So they were so tight and ready. They were just ready to record. All they had to do was turn on the tape player, and that was it. took like a week to record that album. And then LA Woman was sort of done the same way in that we produced it ourselves. Paul Rothschild, who'd done all of our other albums, didn't want to do it for whatever reason, which is in the book. So we just did it at our little rehearsal place, and it was very cool, very laid back kind of feeling. And we actually, that album was, still there?
Yeah, sorry. We're still here.
Okay. LA Woman album was probably the only album where we actually wrote stuff together. It was the four of us. We just sat there and started jamming, and out comes LA Woman. You know, Jim just kind of came up with those words kind of right on the spot, except for the Mr. Mojo Rising part. He already had that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing. And also Riders in the Storm, we were just jamming on Ghost Riders in the Sky one day, and it somehow it turned into Riders on the Storm. You know, it had that same guitar kind of, the Ventures kind of sound.
Yeah, sort of like the Ventures in the Desert.
Yeah, exactly. And then Jim comes up with Riders on the Storm from Ghost Riders in the Sky. Riders in the Storm, you know, it kind of makes sense.
Well, there's a new reissue actually of LA Woman that's coming out in December with a lot of extra studio material. I was lucky enough to do liner notes for it, but there's a photo from those sessions that that is out there, and I've seen it, and it's really interesting because it actually shows the band in your rehearsal space at the Doors Workshop, which was on Santa Monica Boulevard, right off La Cienega. And you can see there's yourself kind of in the corner. Mark Benno, who was the other guitar player on the session, is there. You had Jerry Scheff, who was Elvis's bass player, which was heavy business. And obviously John, Ray, and then Jim. And you're actually all playing together facing each other, almost like in a circle.
Right.
Which it's really an amazing photo because it really captures the bond that you had and still had at that point, even when a lot of other bands would have kind of just fallen by the wayside with everything that had been going on just for the last few years. Still, you were able to pull that together in that moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's the what I'm talking about. When we wrote those songs together, it was just all of us kind of feeding off each other. You know, usually when you record, you put the bass, drums, and keyboard down, and maybe guitar, and then you start overdubbing. You know, you put do the voice later, and it's like piecemeal. Well, this was the opposite of that, and I think that's why the album. You know, I always think that if Jim had come back, I think that's how we would have recorded from then on.
Yeah. Well, there's one question here from James Large, and it's actually sort of comes out of the whole discussion in the book about your Gibson SG. And the question is, any luck finding the lost Gibson, which was the signature guitar that you played on so many of those early shows and early records? And I guess it was stolen from the workshop?
Stolen from our very same place we did LA Woman. And in fact, we just got lucky while writing the book. Jeff Alulis, my co-writer guy, he made friends with some of these Doors, crazy Doors nerds, we call them. And these guys
with
know
great
every...
fondness, I'm sure you say.
Oh, yeah. Now, these guys know everything about the Doors, more than I do, it seems, or at least more than I have forgotten. And so somehow this one guy found the serial number for that guitar. And I told Gibson about it. So we're going to make a film about it and get that serial number out to everybody. And And who knows, maybe I'll find that guitar, just like I think Frampton did. Found one
yeah.
like that, didn't
he? Yeah, he got back, which was the, you know, the guitar that he played on Frampton Comes Alive and all of those all of those records.
That would be great. I mean, whoever has it, I'll bet you they don't even know what it is.
Yeah,
that's the problem. You know, it's probably sitting in somebody's closet somewhere.
Well, at least hopefully it's just being taken care of and not you know, getting tortured by being, you know, played in bars every night.
Well, I'd almost rather have it be that.
Actually, have it put to good use.
I mean, it's just a cheap guitar, but, you know, I always say it's the Indian, not the Arrow.
Yes. Well, you're on the road. I know you're going to be in New York on November 15th and 16th at the Sony Hall doing an evening of the Doors. Greatest hits. You know, what does it feel like to be touring again? When we spoke last year for the new album, we talked for Mojo Magazine, you know, it was the middle of the pandemic, everything was shut down. What is it like to be back out on the road and, you know, have that feeling of these songs being played live and people being able to come out and hear them again?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. We did a couple of shows last weekend. We did one in Philadelphia and one out on Long Island and one up in upstate New York. And it was pretty cool. We actually had Vanilla Fudge was our other act. And so we,
it does sound like a 67 bill at the Fillmore.
Yeah, man, it was cool. Those guys are good guys. You know, I've known them for so long. But anyway, we're going to be back in New York next weekend, or Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I guess. So that should be great.
What does it feel like to play these songs? Like, are there songs actually, when you do play them live now, where you can actually feel yourself getting a charge and playing something new in them? Because one of the things, and I think this is really important, is that, you know, as you know, time passes and, you know, musicians, you know, Jim was one of the first major rock stars to go. We just lost Charlie Watts recently. And yet it's really important that the music be played because it was meant to be played live. That was what it was originally written for. What kind of charge do you get? Maybe some, you can feel something new coming out in the song. Are there particular songs that you're playing in the show where you can think, oh, I'm definitely playing something I did not play before in this, or it does not come from 1968?
Well, a lot of them are like that for me. You know, and it's, the funny thing is, my road crew, they are all Doors tribute guys. They all play in Doors tribute bands. And so they're constantly going, Robbie, you didn't play that right. Yeah, well, that's not
what, it's not the way it is on the record. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And I always tell them, hey, the stuff that's on the record was just one night. That's what happened that night. And it was never the same twice, you know. So, you know, leave it. Let me play what I want to play.
Besides, you were there at the start, so you should have the right to play whatever you want to play.
Right. Well, not according to these guys. I mean, they're good guys, though.
Well, this has been a great pleasure again to speak with you, and I hope everyone out there has enjoyed this as much as I have. Robbie Krieger, the book is Set the Night on Fire, Living, Dying, and Playing Guitar with the Doors, written with Jeff Aloulis. Robbie is on tour with An Evening of the Doors' Greatest Hits. His solo album, The Ritual Begins at Sundown, is out. And Robbie, thank you very much for this, for all the music, and certainly for all of the stories. And congratulations on the book, and best of luck out there on the road.
Oh, thanks, man. Appreciate that. I've got another record coming out too pretty soon.
Oh,
it's called Rocks versus Dub, and it's like a reggae versions of songs that you might know, and it's pretty cool. It's like reggae mixed with some rock and roll and jazz.
Well, that just goes to prove everybody that the story does not stop here. The story continues, and this is the gentleman that's writing the history for you, Robbie Krieger. Thank you very much, and congratulations on the book.
All right, man. Good to talk to you.
All right. Cheers. Thanks a lot.
And all the fans.
Okay. Yes. Yes, the fans.
All right. Cool.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.